Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cobbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today's topic is what has had the eyes of the world for the last 2 weeks. In fact, a birthday party, my birthday party, the people in Egypt kind of celebrated too much. And the end result of it, it has been 2 weeks of tremendous turmoil. The eyes of the world have been on Egypt, and there's interest everywhere. Egypt is Arab's largest country. It's got 80 million people, and that is really why people are so interested in Egypt, because it is the largest nation. It's a very moderate nation compared to such countries as Saudi Arabia and the things we all know about, like Iran, Afghanistan, and Iraq. But it is the fact that it's central, it's close to Israel, and of course the fact that it is an anomaly. It comes with 5,000 years at least of recorded history. It also has largely relying on the tourist industry. And in fact, one of the descriptions which was aired about it was that basically the entirety of Egypt is a large open-air museum. And that really is the case. So we will go into the politics, the future, but also the archaeology and how this is affecting both tourism and the leaders of archaeology and Egyptology. But yes, so what has been happening in the last few weeks has been really interesting. And Kathleen, what's your perspective on all of these events?
Well, in addition to all of the cultural, political repercussions, I also want to talk a little bit later in the show about the spiritual repercussions, because I think we just saw a situation over the last 2 weeks where millions of people became spiritual revolutionaries as well. Because this was a Gandhi-esque type of demonstration. This is millions of people united in a peaceful and powerful, extraordinary protest to change their lives, to change their country, and to change the world. And that's one of the things that I'm so moved about, and it's been such an emotional experience for all of us watching Egypt, really. But for you and I, you know, specifically, we have both been to Egypt. We both have a very strong connection to that country. My love of the Egyptian people is something that I find hard to express. They're absolutely extraordinary people. And one of the things that I ultimately want to talk about is, you know, as an American, I become very frustrated with my own people in circumstances like this, because what I have watched over the last couple of weeks of Egypt trying to liberate itself and trying to create this peaceful and passionate revolution, which is really, it's so record-breaking, it's so groundbreaking, not just in the numbers, but in the way that it comes about, that this is really a revolution of youth in so many ways. There were so many young people here, and this whole idea of it, you know, being inspired by social media and picking up this momentum, and that the people that that the opposition is jailing are people who work for Google. You know, it's people who know how to use the internet effectively and who are strong in social media and understand Facebook and Google, who were really dangerous to the existing old regime. So, you know, my mind just spins when I think about everything that happened over these last couple of weeks, because it's not just about Egypt. It's about the world that we are living in everywhere. And, you know, I'm kind of fragmented because there's so many things to talk about here. So, you know, I'll try to stay on track but I'm still kind of emotional about it. I know that you are too. But to my American friends who are scared about this, you know, I want to say, please give the Egyptians a chance. Don't underestimate what these people have done and what they will continue to do. Of course, I'm frustrated and angry about the sort of usual suspect Glenn Beck right-wing fringe commentators who are you know, more than just hand-wringing. There's a lot of hand-wringing going on, isn't there? How is this going to affect America? Now what's going to happen? This is, sure, let them celebrate today, but tomorrow, it's, you know, everything's going to hit the fan again, and we're all going to be in trouble, and they're going to be overrun by extremists. And there, you know, in sort of a typical American fashion, and I say this as someone who is a proud American, but I am not so proud of this tendency we have to be the most narcissistic country in the world, which is, well, that's all well and good for you, but what about me? What's going to happen to me? That's all well and good that 20 million people are marching peacefully in the streets to change their country, but what's going to happen to me? Well, you know what? Right now, it's not about that. And we are going to talk about what's going to happen to us. And we're going to talk about it from the perspective, you know, although I'm not an expert in the Middle East, I've spent a lot of time there. And I certainly have a point of view based on what I know of the Middle East from my own experiences.
Well, definitely. And I think this is your basic foreign government thing. And it used to be the case of the old Soviet Union, as much as America, is just that the Soviet Union isn't long there. And that is the fact that Egypt was a very stable country. It had a dictatorship. And it had a dictatorship for the last 30 years, and it was intent on staying that way. And I think it caught the world by surprise somewhat. Though over the past 3 weeks, I've actually come across a book by an American-Egyptian journalist called Aladdin, and it's called The Last Pharaoh. And basically it's written, it's published on an auspicious date, July 22nd, 2009. And in that book, he gives a direct warning to Obama, saying, Mr. Obama, in your first term as U.S. president, you will have to deal with the following issues. Egypt is going to collapse. I don't know what's going to happen, precisely, but something is going to happen because this cannot continue. And precisely what is happening in Egypt, just to give you a bit of background, is this. Sadat was assassinated in 1981, in October of 1981. And since 1975, Mubarak had been vice president. And obviously, when Sadat died, Mubarak became president. And he has been president ever since. For 3 decades, he has ruled. And over the last 5 years, he was specifically trying to push his son, specifically his son Gamal, more and more into power. And with the presidential elections of September 2011 coming up, it was assumed generally that Gamal would run for president and that he would be elected, because what has been happening in Egypt is very simple. The first 3 elections, which Mubarak won, he won because there was nobody running against him, which is kind of easy. And he had done that because of constitutional reform and using the emergency laws, which basically said, I'm going through the motions of a democracy, but our nation is so hard, you know, like we need to do this. Then he was forced in 2005 to really allow other people to run. And the usual tricks, which are not uncommon anywhere in vote rigging, happened in Egypt as well. And when the leader of the opposition, who obviously lost, objected and felt that the elections should be redone, he was thrown in jail, subjected to hard labor for a very long period of time. And actually want to find out whether he's still in jail or not over what has been happening in the last few years, because he became one of 30,000 political prisoners who were denied any legal trial whatsoever and just were rotting in jail. In fact, 5,000 of them escaped from one prison alone somewhere in the Sinai region in the last few weeks of these events. So what we had in Mubarak was the person who was voted the 20th worst dictator in the world. It's a country which has abysmal human rights violations. It's a country where 37% of the people are unemployed and 40% of the people live below the poverty belt. So we are talking about a world which is gigantically bad, in which children, young people have no hope. And what the American media still is doing, and the world media is doing, it's not just the American media, the Western media is doing still, is that, you know, forget for a second the Glenbecks with their extreme conspiracy theories about how George Soros is somehow behind this and the Muslim Brotherhood is going to make this the worst nightmare we will ever see. And no doubt the apocalypse is going to happen in 3 weeks from now at 7 o'clock at night. But what we are seeing is an omission of a fact which you mentioned yourself. 20 million people took to the streets and said, this is enough. This can no longer continue like this. One quarter of the Egyptian population went onto the streets and said, this cannot continue. And it finally got the message home. It's one of these things. One of the things which there are two memories about protests which I will always remember. One of them is a very long time ago, about 20 years or so, when I was living in Belgium and I was in Brussels. And Brussels is obviously the headquarters of the European government. And that means that any action against the European government, any demonstration is happening in Brussels. And the most dreaded demonstrations are the farmers when they come to Brussels, and basically they leave a trail of destruction. Glass is shattered, cars who are abandoned, completely destroyed. And I was there about 3 to 4 hours before actually everything started, but the police were already in place, the barbed wire was there, the water guns were there. And there were two things. One of them was that if the army and the police actually turned their machine guns to the other direction, first of all, there would be a coup. But the other thing was how afraid the authorities were, because it needed the barbed wire, it needed all of this to stop certain people in Europe from having some of their wishes driven through. The other thing was that at the time of the Iraq invasion, more than 1 million people marched through the streets of London. And the government basically said, we don't really care about that you go against us in this. You have voted us in, and we are going to stick with Iraq, and we are going to invade this. Even though since Tony Blair has said that he absolutely knew that what he was doing was illegal under any international law. And part of this illegality of the war was part of the reason why there were 1 million people on the street. But it seems to be that if somehow you can gather 25% of your country's population and get them into action and get them on the streets, then even dictators can topple. And I think that is true democracy. That is really, 25% of the people who actively say, enough is enough, this cannot continue. And yes, that is really something which is new, which I think has never been seen before. I go back to the Belgian Revolution, American Revolution, French Revolution. Those were quite small numbers of people who brought about gigantic change, but it was still not anything near 25% of a people. And when I'm reading the international websites of politics which are going on about obviously what's been happening in Egypt, all of a sudden we read that in Iran people are demonstrating, that the Iranian government is making sure that no video of this is coming out, but students and other people are obviously smuggling it through via the internet once again. All of these things are open to the outside world. But that even people are saying this could become a worldwide phenomenon, because young people with no hope for what the world is going to give them, people who are 60, 80 years old, who are living in an ivory tower, completely removed from what people want, from what the real situation is like. They have no idea what's going on in this world where we are trying to create a family, trying to, do stuff with our lives with, and we just feel that this is impossible. And in Egypt, this has led to a gigantic revolution, which I think, the echoes of which are only beginning to rise to the surface.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that not only did we have 20 million people, and that number was, near the end. And in fact, that number, I think, ultimately was a response to Mubarak's last stand. His last stand when he came out on the 10th, and we all thought he was going to announce that he was stepping down, and says, defiantly, I'm not going anywhere. And the response of the people was to bring out more people. and I think that, you know, the center cannot hold. The old world is dying. The old ways are dying, and they need to. It is time for a new way for all of us. The world is changing, and we have to change with it. But one of the things I want to say as well in praise of the Egyptian people is that from January 25th, your birthday when it began, to February 11th, my mother's birthday when it ended, from January 25th to February 11th, these people went through so much. They were goaded. The circumstances in which they were protesting were difficult. They were goaded many, many times into violence. There were many attempts, I think, to get them to erupt into violence, to push them into changing from a peaceful demonstration into something that would be, therefore, easily condemnable. And they never went there. They would not be goaded. They would not fall for these old dirty tricks tactics that have worked for regimes in the past. We're just not going to work this time. These people, this was a determined people. You know, there's the great Irish revolutionary leader Padraig Pearse wrote a poem, "Beware the risen people. Beware the risen people, ye that have harried and held, ye that have bullied and bribed." Because when the people rise against that, they will not be defeated. The people united will never be divided. And that's what Egypt showed us. And I'm going to cry again. I'm going to get emotional about it. It's such a powerful thing for us to remember the world over. And so where I want to transition with that idea is to my more conservative friends and brothers and sisters in the U.S., you know, think about this for a minute before you panic that this is opening up Egypt to some kind of fundamentalist or fanatic invasion. The opposite is really the truth here. What this peaceful revolution in Egypt showed the fanatics and the fundamentalists and the extremists who live by violence is that that is no longer working. The reign of terror is over. It's what is powerful is this peaceful, united protest of the people in the world who want change.
Absolutely. And, you know, Egypt is a very liberal country. You know, I remember my taxi driver, who was also a dear friend, his daughter had to conform, so to speak, when she was. Her parents were liberal and all of that. But there was also this thing of, like, we're raising a child within a certain environment, and how do we give her the freedom but also not kind of, like, you know, make her a social outcast, so to speak, by allowing her completely free rule, which happens in every society. And in her case, that translated to the fact that her parents said, well, you know, maybe you should wear kind of like a baseball cap when you go to school, because that kind of, like, you still adhere to it, to kind of like the social setting of what you need to do. And then when you're 18, you can just decide what you want to do. Egypt is very much a Western country. The Egyptians are extremely, extremely, you know, open to people. They're very amiable. There's hardly any crime in Egypt. When you look at the crime rates for Egypt, it's something like less than 1%. Now, to some extent, you know, because there's so much under the poverty line, there's very little to steal to begin with. But it is a culture which just doesn't do those kind of things.
Well, I want to jump in there because I want to say this, too. In the heavily touristed areas, there is no crime in Egypt. So places where you would think that a poverty-stricken country would be sensitive, pickpockets, that kind of thing, it's extremely unusual. And I remember on my first arrival, the first time I was in Egypt, which was in 1991, and I remember, you know, my first day getting ready to go out and asking the concierge, okay, is where I'm going to walk here, and is this safe? And he just sort of gave me this blank look, and I said, is it safe? And he said, of course it's safe. It's Egypt, you know? And it was just so, he was just so matter of fact about how No one's going to hurt you. No one's going to take anything from you. We don't do that. Egyptian people don't do that. It's just not our way. And my experience in Egypt on the time in all the trips that I have taken there is absolutely that is the case. I mean, I have ridden out into the desert at 4 o'clock in the morning with you know, large groups of Bedouin men who treated me and the other women who were with me like gold. I mean, absolutely respectful and kind and protective. I have never, never felt in any way, shape, or form that I was in danger in Egypt. In fact, I feel safer in Egypt than I feel in a lot of places in my own hometown here in Los Angeles. I think it's a lot more at risk living in LA than I am when I go to Egypt. And from there, I want to transition to what happened in Egypt in 1997. And I know you have a very important story about this. And again, this speaks to the people who are afraid. If you are afraid that Egypt is going to open itself up to fundamentalist incursions, here's something else I want to say. In September of 1997, and you can Google this and you'll get all kinds of information, there was a very, very terrible attack on tourists in Cairo. Outside of the Cairo Museum, a bus was attacked tourists were shot from all over the Western world, but mostly, I think they were mostly Germans, but it was an absolutely horrific attack. There were actually two terrible terrorist attacks in September of 1997 in Egypt against tourists. The attackers were not Egyptian. I was in Israel at the time, and I was in Israel, and I had a plane ticket to fly to Egypt the day that the attacks happened. Against everyone's best recommendations, I went anyway. We went the next day. And I will tell you something, and everyone said, don't do this, Egypt's unstable, all these things are happening, it's a terrible time to go. I will tell you that I have never felt safer in my life because the Egyptian government and the Egyptian people were so determined to make me, as a guest in their country and as a tourist, understand that they wanted me there. They wanted my business. They wanted me to feel safe there. They wanted me to spend money there, because this is the other thing that makes Egypt so different from any other Islamic nation. It is a country that understands and cherishes the importance of its tourist trade. The Egyptian government, everything about Egypt runs on tourism. It is the lifeblood of that country. And the people know that, and they want to protect that, and they want us there, and they want us to feel good and safe and comfortable, because that makes their lives an awful lot better when tourism is booming. Those people are hurting so much right now because there are no tourists in Egypt. And there are children who are not eating today as a result of this revolution because there are no tourists. Their family businesses are not being nurtured. And so, you know, after I arrived in Egypt in 1997, the way that we were protected, the way the hotels were protected and the tourist sites were protected, was such a clear show to me of how much the Egyptians wanted us to know that they were no part of this extremism. And I know that you also had some familiarity with that era and what happened there. And you have a very important story about 1997, and I'd love for you to tell that story.
Well, absolutely, because I had a dear friend, Wim Zitman, and you should actually all read his books. One of them is in English. It's called Egypt's Image of Heaven. He was there. He was in Luxor just before the attacks happened in the valley, at the entrance of the Valley of the Kings. And he had gone to Aswan. And he was in Aswan when it happened. And because everybody was flown out, it was really, you know, the airports were horrific, probably even more horrific than they were in the last few weeks. And obviously Aswan Airport, for people who've been there, couldn't cope with the amount of tourists who were in Aswan or around. So these people had to go back, and they had to go back to Luxor. Now his tour party had to wait until they were flown out, and they decided to actually go to Karnak Temple. And the experience at Karnak Temple was actually that they were surrounded by military people who were protecting them there to make sure that nothing would actually happen. Because just like countries like Mexico, the headline news of a tourist got killed by destroys a nation's economy, which is why I have had, like, you know, military escorts on certain trips to Mexico. And then you ask them, kind of, you know, why is there a military convoy behind our bus? I mean, it looks impressive, but why? And basically you get to hear, well, a year ago, the local people here were kind of thinking of rebelling, and now you guys are a tourist, and if they think that they might want to do something, it's like, you know, it's like 0.0001% that they might do something against the tourists, but the country just cannot take that risk. And so what happened in Egypt is really the story is this. Egypt, because it's liberal, because it's not fundamentalist at all, certain people, fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists, hate it. And so what they try to do is you try to bring it down, you try to starve the people, and then you try to see whether you can work with them. And they've been trying to do that for a very long period of time, and they've never succeeded. And right now it's not going to succeed either, because what we have seen is precisely that. What happened was that the terrorists came from abroad. They were trained elsewhere. They entered the country via Libya, even though they weren't from Libya themselves. They went, they hijacked the bus. And when the story of the fact that a bus full of tourists had been hijacked by terrorists was learned by the local people who were all around, who had their shops in the process of being set up, these people, these Egyptian people, ran to their home or to their car or wherever they had their own weapon, and they were going to shoot the terrorists because they wanted to lynch the terrorists. Unfortunately, the people on the bus were used as human shields and were basically shot when you know they realized that the local Egyptians were going to take matters into their own hands. And what was happening was also that when the Egyptians kind of, like, you know, were doing this, the police actually arrived on the scene too late. By the time the police came, all they found were dead tourists and dead terrorists, because everything had happened before. You know, this was something whereby the Egyptian people said, we do not stand by this. We cannot allow this to happen. And what was happening was disastrous, because for 2 years, basically, their economy failed. They were reduced. And Wim said that when they basically came back from Karnak and Luxor, that final day, and when they were going to the airport, he saw people cry on the streets, because what they realized that for the next few years there were men who could not feed their family, their children might starve, there was simply nothing they could do. Because even then, Mubarak, who has now an estimated personal fortune of $70 billion, had basically drained the country. There was no economy, there was no investment outside of anything to do with tourism. And, you know, this is what Egypt was, this is what Egypt remained, and the eyes of the world just let it happen. You know, I remember a horrific scene in 1998 when I went to Alexandria, and this was in July. And in July, it's extremely hot in Cairo, it's even hotter in Luxor. In fact, I believe it was 85 degrees Fahrenheit at 3 a.m., when the plane touched down at Luxor Airport that day. And so I went into Alexandria, and the taxi driver made use of the occasion to see his wife and kids, who had a tiny apartment off the beach. And Alexandria has got a tiny beach, and it's like 5, 6, 7, 8 rows at high tide, lying on the beach and trying to get some breeze in there. But 100 yards on the side streets are people, hundreds of people, sitting in the shade without any possession, without any property. A blanket is practically all they have. No means of income, nothing whatsoever. And it is, you know, I have seen people cry when they go to Peru and they see the poverty of abandoned children and things like that. But the poverty in Alexandria back then, a decade ago, was so visible you know, so incredible. Just imagine a street full of people sitting there, all of them without a job. And they don't even beg because they know that there's not a single person, you know, who's not even going to start giving, you know, hundreds of people that kind of situation. And actually, you know, it's got to be said, those were the good days of Egypt, because since then it dramatically declined. Poverty went down to where 40% of the people are living under the poverty line.
I just want to say again, clearly, Mubarak's personal wealth is estimated at $70 billion. $70 billion when more than half of his nation is practically starving and are essentially, in many cases, homeless. They live in some of them live in tents. They live in makeshift houses. It's absolutely, it's appalling. And I had no idea. I wasn't looking. I mean, I knew about the poverty, of course. I've been to Egypt a number of times. I certainly knew that there was a very, very strong proportion of how much the haves had versus how little the have-nots had. I had no idea we were talking about something as extreme as a personal wealth of $70 billion. And from what I understand, and you are far more expert on this than I am, the people around him immediately and who worked for him and some of his cabinet ministers, who we're going to also ultimately talk about as well, also had millions upon millions of dollars. And there's just this very, very, very small pocket of extremely fat cats who were essentially living off the backs of the Egyptian people for the last two decades and bleeding that country to death.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, before Mubarak went, there were reports about how some members of the cabinet had been sacked. And just to once again underline, Mubarak's family, it should be said, has $70 billion because his only fortune is only deemed to be worth $40 billion. Only 40. The rest is divided by his two sons, who each have roughly $15 billion each. So what has happened there is that actually most of that money came from government contracts to do with defense. We all know that the defense industry has got the most gigantic kickbacks. Some of these contracts, a golden handshake of $1 billion is actually not that much. It's roughly 10% of the deal which is going through. And it's basically an agent's fee, what you pay for these contracts. So, you know, the military industrial complex, it's a big business. And with the you know, communism in Egypt, I believe, was ousted a bit before Mubarak came to power. So you probably know where that money came from. And those are kind of like the same people who are kind of hinting that, you know, we should be very worried now about what is going to happen with Egypt, because Egypt might no longer need a ridiculous amount of F-16s or whatever they had in the pipelines of buying. So that is one thing, his extraordinary personal fortune. But everybody, you know, Egypt, the bakshish is your standard way of paying in Egypt. And it's also the standard way of doing business. So on a more archaeological level, there is, of course, Dr. Hawass, the leading Egyptologist, the person who has had television series, the face of Egyptology as we speak. He reported into the Minister of Culture, a guy called Farouk Hosni, who was hated in Egypt. Hosni, wherever he went, was protected by at least six bodyguards because basically people wanted to kill him on sight because he was just so hated. And because he was simply, people knew what he did and people, you know, just tried to do something about it. The Minister of the Interior was another very hated individual, obviously, for all the reasons which are clear. He was the one who, it's got to be said, was probably in a very unfortunate position because he had to carry out what Mubarak implemented. So whether you're the nicest guy or the greatest criminal, it doesn't really matter. So they left. The Minister of the Interior, is under investigation, or was placed under investigation by Mubarak. Whether that's going to have any effect later on obviously be a thing of the future. But in all of this turmoil, Hawass did become a very interesting person because Egypt is an outdoor museum. You're going to ask the head of the entertainment industry, so to speak, what is happening. And very early on, the Egyptian museum there were stories about how it was looted, how everything was destroyed, how it was in danger of being destroyed. And to some extent, some of these reports were exaggerated, and to some extent, they were true. They were true in the sense that the Egyptian museum is geographically located next to the party headquarters of Mubarak's party. So any attack against Mubarak's party headquarters, it was basically felt that if that building was put on fire, then parts of the Egyptian museum were under immediate threat, even if it was a victim of circumstances, so to speak. But it was also very clear that because this was a very unexpected uprising, that on the first Friday, January the 28th, the military were not in place, they were not protecting any sites, and about 1,000 people were able to jump into a courtyard of the museum over a fence, and about 10 people entered the museum and began to loot parts of the museum, but specifically the museum gift shop, where there was an extraordinary amount of beautiful jewelry, which obviously they could sell on the black market and various other things. Originally, Hawass said that 70 objects had been damaged or taken from the Egyptian museum, and that everything was under control. However, in the day after Mubarak resigned, Hawass announced that actually 18 quite precious pieces from the Egyptian museum have disappeared. Now, people are wondering whether he just didn't know or whether he was lying. Well, the early reports said that there were objects which had disappeared from the Tutankhamun exhibition, the Akhenaten exhibition, and objects to do with Yuya, who people like Ahmed Osman believe might actually be the biblical Joseph. And Hawass initially said, no, that's not the case. None of these three collections have been damaged in anything that has happened. The fact that he went on the record and said, actually, they have, these 18 objects have disappeared, strongly suggests that this has happened, that he knew about it. And there is actually one archaeologist who in the past few days has gone on record and said that he is 95% sure that Hawass lied because he wanted to save face personally, but also save face of the Mubarak regime. He wanted to show that Mubarak was in power, that everything was business as usual, that there should nothing to be feared from. And, initially Hawass was one of those people who just appeared on TV because every TV station in the world has got his phone number, and so they can contact him. Then he became a minister of antiquities, and he became a politician. He became a member of the political side of things, and he gave an interview, he gave several television interviews. On February the 6th, he gave an interview with Andrew Marr of the BBC in London, in which he very much acts like a politician. He says that Mubarak should not be allowed to go, that Mubarak is essential for the transition period, that Egypt is safe under Mubarak, that he has, that Mubarak basically needs, that Egypt needs the country, sorry, that Mubarak needs to stay so that the country of Egypt can survive. And he, on his website and in some of the other interviews, he makes it clear that he really feels that these students should just go. They should vacate Tahrir Square because that's kind of like, they're stopping Egypt from doing things. And he makes it clear that the Sphinx is crying, how he can see that the Sphinx is crying, and how, the 9 years of work which he has done is being destroyed by these students. More recently, in the last few days, actually, there have been personal demonstrations of 200 Egyptian graduates in archaeology and Egyptology who have demonstrated in front of his office and have told Hawass to get out, who've told him that he has to leave his position, that he's all about propaganda, that he has nothing to do with Egyptology as such, that he doesn't treat the people as Egypt, the students, the scientists, that he treats them, that he pays them below the poverty wages. That he should go, as I said. There are stories that his office is actually empty, that all of his personal papers have been removed there, that he's expected not to last. Already, he in Egypt, you are supposed to step down at the age of 60. Because of mass unemployment, of course, they want to get the younger generation into work. He stayed on up to the age of 62, which was by a special dispensation already. And then, as people might who've seen Chasing Mummies actually saw, he gets the phone call from Mubarak himself, whereby Mubarak basically went outside every law in Egypt and put him and gave him a lifelong position as head of Egyptology. So he is very much a child of the Mubarak regime. When you go onto the internet, you will see how it's said that he's very closely affiliated with Suzanne Mubarak, the wife of Hosni Mubarak. But specifically, it's not so much via the wife that he's associated with the Mubarak regime. He is the Mubarak regime and has always been. He has nothing to do with Egyptology. He has all to do with politics. He always ruled as a politician. And there's a very interesting episode in a book which I've just been reading. It's Robert Temple's Egyptian Dawn. And Robert Temple, through a Greek, I think, scientist, actually is able to do some dating of some monuments in the Giza Plateau and in other places. And Temple, and specifically the archaeologist, gets the permission from the various parties which you have to consult in Egypt to get the initial permit, which is a scientific committee. It's all done by scientists and the like. And he's been granted all of the papers. And then the next step is that you are vetted for by the police, by the military, so that you get your security clearances. Temple is in Egypt between getting those two permits, and he decides to pay Hawass a visit, and which is basically an informal visit, and basically that Hawass knows that in the near future, between 6 and 12 months, somebody will be coming along, and they kind of like, you know, will have to work together. And Hawass looks at this permit, is clearly unaware that this has happened, and basically tells Temple, you will not dig there, and there. This is not something which is going to happen. And Temple goes, but look, I have a permit. And Hawass basically shoves it back to Temple and says, like, I don't give a damn about this permit. This permit doesn't exist. And what he finds six months later is indeed that the military regime, the military this and the police that, have changed the permit. All of a sudden, Temple and his professor is no longer allowed to dig and take samples where Hawass said he would never be able to do it. And it's very interesting, isn't it, that here we have what is allegedly the head of Egyptology, the head scientist in Egypt, who had no idea what was going on in scientific circles, but knows perfectly well how to manipulate the political and military regime of Egypt to get his scientific permits changed.
Well, you know, anyone who has listened to this show knows that we have talked about, you know, the tyranny of Zahi Hawass and how he runs that plateau he is the pharaoh and it is his own personal kingdom, and that so much of what he has done has resulted in us being less informed about Egypt than ever before. We have done several shows with Andy Collins, and I would definitely recommend for anyone listening to this broadcast to go back into our archives and have a listen at the Andy Collins interviews, because we talk with Andy about his extraordinary work in Egypt and all the pioneering work he has done under the Giza Plateau, and how over and over again, basically, Hawass has blocked him from making the kind of progress that could really, you know, be extraordinary for all of us. And what this takes me to is what this week, those 150 archaeology graduates who were outside of Dr. Hawass's door screaming at him to go, what they were saying, I think, is extremely important. And what they were saying was, he doesn't care about us. He only cares about propaganda. And that is the charge that these young, upcoming, excited archaeologists in Egypt are throwing at him. And this is, once again, Hawass is part of an old world, and that old world is dying. And these kids are part of a new world, and it's a new world that wants the truth. And that's what's happening in Egypt. The truth is exploding. The truth is coming out of the ground, and it is moving through the people. It is moving in their hearts and in their minds and in their actions. And these archaeology students got into archaeology for a reason. They are passionate about their country. They're passionate about what they're doing. They want to know the truth, and they know that for 20 years, Zahi Hawass has been keeping the truth of Egyptian archaeology away from all of us, and it's time for that to be over. And I'm telling you, I am as excited about the potential removal of Zahi Hawass from this position as I am about the rest of what's happening in Egypt, because this constitutes freedom all the way around. It's freedom for the people, it's freedom for the archaeology, it's freedom for the past. Most of all, it's freedom for the truth. And that, for me, is so exciting. And I certainly know that you feel that way. And I reach out to our friends like Andy Collins today, who have done so much work in Egypt, and say to them, I hope that everything that's happening in Egypt now opens up so many channels for you to pursue your extraordinary work, because I don't think the truth is going to want to be kept in the dark much longer. And that truth is stronger than Zahi Hawass's ego. It is stronger than Zahi Hawass's bank account, because let's be clear, Zahi Hawass is not a poor man. And wherever he ends up, he's going to be fine. So don't feel too sorry for him if you see him on TV and think that he's, you know, charming or interesting or funny. Chasing mummies certainly opened us all up to a glimpse of the Zahi Hawass who rules that plateau with an iron fist, and has controlled the truth for far too long.
Absolutely. There are, the most telling thing, about 2 years ago, I think it is now, I wrote an article which was basically, when I get mad, I write articles and then they get published. But this was one which wasn't run just by Nexus, but also by Atlantis Rising. And it was precisely about what Hawass was doing. And he's been sitting on carbon-14 dating of the Great Pyramid, which shows that the Great Pyramid is about 500 years older than what is commonly accepted. And he's basically been sitting on that against, like, you know, top scientists like Mark Lehner, who, you know, it's got to be said, are basically in his pocket or half in his pocket, who do not have the guts to stand out against him. But, you know, he's been sitting on this completely scientifically valid material for years. I think it's coming up to a decade, if not more now, because it doesn't fit within the image of Egypt, which he is trying to do. There have been TV documentaries where it's known that he was saying, look, I have just found something. And what he had found had been known for 15 years. It's known that he has made bogus revelations. It's known that he has made bogus press releases. It is known that he has basically denied permits to people who he knows are going to dig somewhere where they can find certain things which he wants to keep hidden. There was one gigantic allegation made a few years ago of a person who had gone in Saqqara. There's a Serapeum, which is an underground labyrinth, and there are gigantic granite sarcophaguses there, who are 400 tons in weight, just gigantic. And the most massive ones are without any inscription whatsoever. They believe that originally there were bulls in there, but nobody knows for sure, and nobody really knows or is able to explain how they were ever made. Sarcophagi without any inscription whatsoever, at least in 1997, and I've actually forgotten, but roughly just before 1997, the Serapeum was closed, allegedly because there was some kind of gas in there, which was basically going to kill people who were in there. And then about 5 years ago, it was found that Egyptian workers were working in there without any gas mask whatsoever, without anything. And then the story was like, you know, does he not care about these people or what? But a journalist took photographs of what was happening, and a coffin, a sarcophagus, which didn't have an inscription in, let's say, 1995 or thereabouts, when he last went in there, by 2008 had acquired an inscription. And he was adamant that saying Hawass is preparing another bogus revelation, the mystery of these sarcophagi and how they were made, which nobody for hundreds of years has been able to explain. Hawass is going to pretend that this is, you know, probably whatever dynasty. He probably can't get away with the 26th dynasty. But with another dynasty, you know, he's going to explain this away. And really, the mystery of ancient Egypt, the beauty and all of the mysteries have been locked under key. Again, Temple was able to get into, you know, the pyramid. It's a very long story, so I won't go through it. But basically, he was able to get in a site which Hawass said he wasn't going to get into, basically because the Egyptian government, which is a gigantic bureaucracy, hadn't given the updated paperwork to the people on the Giza Plateau, so they let him in a site where they shouldn't have let him in. And one of these sites is the Sphinx and the Valley Temple, which are gigantic monuments, which in every episode of Ancient Aliens or any kind of ancient technology episode is always featured because it is simply inexplainable what is going on there. And he actually found that when he was given permission to get in there, nobody was able to get the key because in those structures, in part of those structures, nobody had gone in there in the last 30 years. Welcome to Egypt under Zahi Hawass, who pretends that in the last decade he has done so much for Egypt, whereas basically he had put it under lock and barrel. He built a gigantic wall around the Giza Plateau so nobody could get in. He was destroying the life of a village near the Sphinx because he was relocating the entrance somewhere else where he could have easier access and better control over who came in and who went out. In the recent reports about the uprising, there are stories about how the villagers on the Giza Plateau hate Hawass because basically they were destroying their family's income and regulating their lifestyle in a way which was also completely nonsensical. Who cares where you get on a camel? You know, it's a tourist thing. You're supposed to be for fun. Giza Plateau has become very much an ugly place under Hawass with a gigantic wall, which I hope is going to be broken down as soon as Mr. Hawass disappears from public life.
Mr. Hawass, tear down this wall. Yeah, so I think that there's so much going on in Egypt that is so exciting and so beautiful and has gigantic repercussions for all of us because, you know, it goes back to the times they are changing. We've talked on this show certainly about the run up to 2012 and what does that mean? That it's not the end of the world, it's the beginning of the world. But it's the end of an old world. It's the end of an old way of living, of thinking. And so for me, watching these brave, brilliant, beautiful people take back their country and demand basic human rights was incredibly inspirational. You know, we haven't talked about the fact that a lot of this was launched by a Facebook group in honor of this 27-year-old Egyptian man who was beaten by the police. And this Facebook group brought this terrible beating to light. And one of the things that it did, which I actually found incredibly disturbing, and I still have a really hard time looking at this. It's now on Wikipedia. It's all over the internet now. But they published the photograph, the autopsy photograph of this young man. And it does not look like a human being anymore. He was beat so terribly. His face is so deformed. His jaw is dislocated. And, you know, his crime in quotation marks, may be that he knew something about the corruption of certain Egyptian police. And this is the police state that, you know, young, passionate, intelligent people in Egypt were up against. And it was the publication of this young man's picture that really started to stir up the youth of Egypt. You know, we are all Khalil Said. We are all this man. And I'm still in awe of what they were able to create. And I'm in awe of the example that the Egyptian people have given to all of us. And I just, you know, want to say, you know, I wish I wish that everything continues to flourish for the Egyptian people. I hope that they're able to rebuild their country in a way that is for them, in a way that tourism is able to come back and that the country can flourish anew. You know, these are my prayers to the Egyptian people, as well as my gratitude for everything that they have shown us in terms of what people can do when their hearts and their spirits are in the right place.
Absolutely. And, you know, the classic line was when the revolution had happened, when Mubarak had stepped down, the people behind the Facebook group of Khalal Said, they said that they thanked the people of Tunisia, they thanked the people of Egypt for showing them what could happen. And in a very moving way, as you said, which was reminiscent of the movie V for Vendetta, he says, like, we are all Khalal Said. You know, he's in all of us. And I think, you know, to some extent, the reason why the old world is in such diabolical state is because there's lots of lethargy, both from the people in power and the people outside of power. And what the Egyptian revolution, because that really is what it was, has shown is that action and you know, people saying, look, you know, this is not something which we can no longer stand for. This is enough. And I think the biggest enemy of Egypt is not the Muslim Brotherhood, but lethargy. And what we have definitely seen in the few days since February 11th is that at every moment in time, they are willing to go back on the streets and say, OK, army, you're in power now, but this is what we want. We want to do this. We want to do that. They are keeping the people on their toes. And to quote FIFA from that once again, there's a classic line of, the people should not be afraid of their government. The government should be afraid of the people.
And one more really quick thing. The other thing that this revolution has shown us is that the people will not be lied to anymore. There will be no hiding. When you look at the first couple of days, what you see is you see reporters being attacked. You have Anderson Cooper being attacked by a group of Mubarak's thugs. You have people who are trying their hardest, the old regime, trying to keep the information away from people like us. They did not want us to know the truth. And on February 11th, I watch Egyptian people carrying journalists on their shoulders and hugging and kissing journalists and saying, thank you. Thank you for not giving up on us. Thank you for staying here and telling the truth. And that is a huge piece of what is happening now. It's about transparency. It's about people seeing the truth and bringing everything to light, the truth against the world.